Speaking of reliability. Friends talking about reliability engineering topics. Let's discuss how to create and improve your reliability program and your career.
Welcome to Speaking of Reliability. This is Fred Schenkelberg.
And this is Carl Carlson.
Hey, Carl. It's early here. We kind of between daylight savings time and scheduling a little bit early than normal for me, I might be a little bit slower off the uptake today. So you can pick the topic.
Okay, I'll pick the topic. And you sound good, Fred.
Right.
So you're doing fine.
All right.
I was actually thinking about what would be fun to talk about, and one of my early realizations as a reliability person had to do with the subject of reliability allocation. So I'd love to get your view on some things.
Okay.
And maybe some listener views. The back in my GM years, early on, when I first picked up the reliability group, they were involved in a lot of reliability allocation. That was like the big method at the time.
Okay.
And it's not the only thing they did, but they were pretty active in allocating reliability to the lower levels. And they did it with a whole set of things that over time I realized had some erroneous assumptions in them. So I wrote a paper and I presented both at GM and at a conference called The Pitfalls of Reliability Allocation. And I wanted to share with you some of the pitfalls and see what your view is on these, to see if you agree. And maybe the listeners would chime in at some point and let us know if you agree.
Okay. Well, before you get too far along that line, because I'm already thinking of like a dozen or so of them. If you've got, as a listener, if you've got a few ideas, why don't you just jot them down real quick or make a note of them, which ones are your favorites, and we'll see what Carl comes up with or came up with over the years ago and do a little bit of a comparison. But where to start, Carl? I mean, there's all kinds of different assumptions, and there's different methodologies for doing allocation. But I think the number one biggest assumption, and I hear about it from engineers all the time, is that if you assume that every component can cause the system to fail in an equal way, then you allocate out to all those different parts equally. And some parts are more important than others, and some have little to no effect on the overall system performance, and some degrade it and so on. But the most common allocation schemes I know of pretty much make that assumption that everything has the same impact on the overall system performance if it fails. So that's one I'll throw out there.
Okay. And it's what I call pitfall number two.
Oh, I missed the top one. Oh, darn.
Well, and they're not necessarily prioritized. So the making inaccurate assumptions.
Okay.
And so if you have underlying, and that I think that should be number one. If you have inaccurate underlying assumptions in anything you do, not just reliability allocation, you're going to have problems. And so many people assume an exponential distribution, and because that facilitates the mathematics of reliability allocation. And
yeah, I'm going to argue with that. It facilitates it only in making it easy to do by hand.
Yes.
It doesn't make, I mean, if you used Weibull and log normal and all the other distributions,
yeah,
we have the tools today to do that. So that's bogus that it makes it easy.
That should go
easy.
Away.
Yeah.
Yep. That is a bogus rationale. So that was one of them. I'll just jump in on one of them, which is allocation can become a numbers game.
Mm-hmm.
And that's one of the pitfalls where people go, aha, I've allocated reliability down to the door hinge. So that would mean that we have people have reliability requirements and they know what to do and everything's fine. That the problem I've seen in some companies, and I experienced it at GM years ago, is the numbers game of allocation having some value by itself. And of course, the allocated numbers don't have any value by themselves. It's, do you have the right reliability requirements? Are they more than numbers? Because reliability requirements are only partly related to numbers. And are you executing accordingly? So that was a pitfall of the numbers game.
Well, I kind of lost you there. Because, I mean, you, if you're doing a tops-down allocation, and that door handle has got to be exceedingly five nines plus reliable over its duration, yet the technology is not there to achieve that. And it's just the numbers game can be that you just allocate that because there's so many components and the assumptions underlying it of saying, well, we're going to, these other parts have to be more reliable, so we're going to give them a better number and just allocate, for lack of a better verb at the moment, the door hinges have to be five nines reliable, and they have to deal with it. Now they have an unreasonable goal in front of them that their technology just even can't even accommodate. And I think there's a problem there. And then vice versa, if you got something that's really good and you don't allocate to its capability, then you're squandering, you're forcing other parts of the system to be better than, expect them to be better than they actually are. Is that what you're talking about?
No, that isn't, but that is a pitfall. And I think you're describing it very well, which is you can either under or over challenge the team, either with too high of a number that, where, like you say, the technology is not there, or you could be too low of a number where the capability is well beyond what you're targeting. And I would characterize that as benchmarking, where you need to have some type of reality on what that reliability target is, and not just purely allocate, but understand what the capability is, understand what the current reliability is, so that you don't under or over achieve on it. What I was referring to in the numbers game is the definition of reliability, where one of the four elements is a probability.
Right.
And the other ones can get missed if you purely work on the numbers. That's the point I'm making about numbers game, is you're not getting the full benefit of what is reliability, the probability that the item will achieve the intended function under stated conditions over a period of time. And those are really important elements, as you've teach, and I know as well. And so if you get caught up in the numbers game, you miss out on those other elements.
I know what you're talking about now. That makes sense. And even if you get the probabilities right, you get information about the various subsystems and components, key components and their technologies, and you lay out allocations both top down and plus bottoms up, and the numbers all work, and you have a big spreadsheet and you're rerunning the numbers all the time. You're exactly right, is that it conveys that the probability is the only number. Now, this gets facilitated by using MTBF, where everybody believes that that's the only number you need. And then you lose the duration piece of it. I've seen it gone to an extreme, is saying, well, I made the number. I tested 100 wheels on my vehicle for an hour each, and so I made my number.
Right, exactly. In fact, just as an aside, since this is a sort of a free-flowing conversation, is I'm sure there's seven pitfalls to MTBF. Metric.
Oh, yeah. At
we'll
least.
We'll get to that some other time.
don't get me started.
Let's see now. I'm just looking at the paper that I wrote. One of the pitfalls that I really ran into was treating reliability as a goal. Even if you get the right reliability numbers, what we were doing back then, and one of the lessons I learned, is that because what we used to do is issue a memo to the department. Here's your hinge goal for reliability.
Right.
And that memo would sort of go nowhere. And I learned that we needed to fold reliability into specifications, and thereafter, all technical specifications for the components and subsystems would include a reliability section that had the four elements of reliability. And so treating reliability as a goal rather than a requirement that is measurable during product development was one of the lessons learned, or I can call it a pitfall.
Yeah, one of my clients years and years ago is a medical device product, and their quality organization would go through their engineering requirements document or their marketing requirements document, kind of the this is what this product is supposed to be documents. And they would tag in those requirements documents, they would number these are things we have to do. And they would be agreed on, and management would say, yep, in the engineering teams, everybody else said, yep, we have to do that. And the quality organization in that group would use that as their yardstick to say, well, if you don't prove that you've met this requirement, we won't sign off on it, and we have to go keep working on it. And so they kind of used it as a big hammer at the end of the process. And it was a bit overbearing, and they didn't actually ever roll up their sleeves until much later that they actually said, oh, geez, we're smart people. We should help them actually achieve the goals, not just figure out how to measure it and tell them they didn't make it, which is that might be a whole nother topic.
Yeah.
So they would create these requirements and tag them, and the group would. So they had that dynamic in it. So when I came along and said, oh, we need to figure out how reliable do we want to be so that we can set up what our design for reliability are, where the focus, you know, all the other tools, and we got to allocation. And they said, no, we can't call it a requirement. If we call it a requirement, this other group latches onto it, and then we have to prove it. Right.
Yes, that's exactly what I'm talking about.
Right, like that door hinge, and now we need 6,000 samples to run for 3 years to prove that we have enough reliability on this allocation to this door hinge, and that's just not going to happen. And so they said, well, let's call it an objective, or I think it was a goal. Let's call it a goal because we're squishy on those. But as soon as we use the word requirement,
right,
whatever works in your organization, if it becomes whatever other term, and now it's ignored, that's a problem. And then I would say, no, you need to actually pay attention to this. If the existing mechanisms then force it into the conversation and into the design, then call it that. If the team recognizes that reliability is important, and that we need to deal with this, and we don't need this extra headache, call it whatever you want, but make sure you're dealing with it. I think that's another pitfall is call it whatever you want and then ignore it, and then that's a problem.
So that therein is the key. It's not so much the language, because some companies are very goal-oriented. Mm-hmm. If they set a goal, they will work on the steps to achieve it. That's fine. And so I think you're saying the right words. Another one was this was is one of my most important pitfalls back at that time. Mm-hmm. It sounds like we've crossed this bridge already, but back in the early 1990s when I wrote the paper, this was big. Believing that reliability does not have to be engineered into the product or process.
Oh, there's still people that believe that. There still is.
Well, back in the early 90s, the way the product development process worked in a lot of companies was design it, then figure out how to make it reliable.
Or just test it to prove that it's reliable. Don't even redesign it. Yeah.
Yep. Test it to prove it's reliable, or if it fails, you might have to do fixes to make it reliable or whatever. But this false belief that reliability does not have to be engineered into the product or process, and that was one of my lessons learned.
I had one boss, and I'm was taking a bunch of statistics courses at the time and did data analysis and calculating sample sizes and everything else. And I remember this discussion, and they will remain unnamed, as, what do you mean it passed? It failed that test? We'll just keep testing it until it passes. And
right.
Why don't we learn something from this and do something different that actually works? Is you can't, I mean, here's the math guy, you know, if 50% of them fail, if I test 10 of them, half of those will still fail. If I test 20, maybe 48% will pass. Is that good enough, you know?
Yeah. Or another, maybe an axiom from that or a subset of that is the one-off, the view that that failure is a one-off. It doesn't really represent what's happening.
Yeah. There's probably pitfalls of reliability testing is another. We could have a whole series on this. But yeah, there's those arguments that, on the contrary, though, I'm working with a client now that is just, it's amazing. We've had a number of failures. It's late in the program by the time we got into the lab and actually got some stress testing done on this thing. And the response to the first failures at beyond the edge of where they expect the system to have to operate. And they noticed a couple of things and they went, you know, this is good. We got to deal with this. And they are doing all the right steps and failure analysis and everything else. But it's all the way through the organization. It's like, oh, let's understand this better rather than the five standard excuses. Well, that'll never happen in the field. Well, that's not supposed to work there. Well, of course you broke it. It's overstressed or... the one you just mentioned is that, well, that only happened on that one. That's a prototype. But don't worry about that one.
Yeah, like, or it only happened once.
Yeah. That only happened. Or they didn't blame the vendor either, which was very refreshing. So
yes.
It's like, okay. It can be a huge trap is that you get great information and then ignore it. That's a problem.
And then there's another... There's really two of them that you had brought up at the beginning, and we'll kind of round off with those. But there's a pitfall of overemphasizing and or overtesting low priority areas. Mm-hmm. In other words, you got the 9999, but that might be a part that has been proven. It has no field issues. There's no new technology, and so then you can spend a huge amount of time and effort to prove out that reliability. And then the converse to that is you may have very critical areas because of new technology, new environments, new or previous field history or other things, and a critical part. And that has to be very highly emphasized with a whole set of reliability methods. And so the purely going by allocation, you can end up possibly overemphasizing some areas and underemphasizing others.
Well, at some point you have to balance. I mean, the allocation is marching orders, right? Here's the targets. And it doesn't imply, at least in my book, it doesn't imply that you have to test to prove it. Especially like a classic example is that I was working with a group that had a very high volume product and they had this small, like a Wi-Fi card, or Bluetooth or whatever its technology was, a very simple, small little card that had been in products for about 4 years already, millions and millions of made. None had ever failed. Yield in the factory was really high. It was a simple design using basic technology, and a brand new reliability engineer on the mothership product that was using this device came to me and said, you have to prove your allocated reliability for that card. Well, what's the reliability target? And it was like five or six nines or nine, eight nines or some ridiculous number. And I said, no, we're not going to do a test. And he was expecting to see a test. He wanted my test plan to do that. And I says, here's 5 years of field data that show that it works beyond your expectation right there. If that's not good enough, you know, what is it?
Yeah. And therein, I think, kind of summarizes because there is a role for reliability allocation. It can be a very important tool, but it needs to be in context with other tools and other parts of the reliability program. And because you're going to analyze your field history, you're going to analyze your change point analysis and other type analyses that reliability allocation fits into. And so if it becomes the end-all, cure-all, that'd be a mistake. But if you do it properly, then it can inform or be input to what you decide to do.
That's right. I agree with you, Carl. It really is to me, it's an ongoing discussion. It starts early in the program saying, well, what technology do we have available that can meet these objectives, right? And right. Whether it's field history or it's new technology or whatever. But as the program continues and as we learn more about where we are versus the allocation, you should be changing the allocation to reflect reality and use it to prioritize, along with FMEA and other tools, where you need to focus more, where you need to learn more.
And, excellent.
You know, if a high priority, it wipes out the system, has a high consequence when it fails, is failing, and it requires two or three different types of stresses for different failure mechanisms, that's going to eat up the entire testing budget. Right there.
Right.
And it may well be the perfect thing to go investigate versus the door hinge. Although I've heard about the GM door hinges.
Yeah, okay. Well, and I think you're bringing up a great point, which is the allocation or the system reliability model needs to be updated and kept current and kept informed by testing and other types of analyses. Mm-hmm. And it become a great tool for you that way, sort of a living reliability model.
Yeah. One quick story, and we'll wrap it up, is that, and I'm sure I've talked about it before, is this one group had a technical marketing manager that knew that their product was on the ropes in the market compared to other offerings in their marketplace. And reliability was the number one thing customers were complaining about for their product and enjoying with others. So he created a very simple series system reliability model, a reliability block diagram, and used what information he had available. And half of it, he said, was just a guess where our allocations were to the subsystems. Their design group was broken down by subsystems. There's a mechanical group, an electrical group, a group for the motherboard, for the IC, for power supply, and so on. And he brought that to the team meeting and said, you know, here's a way to look at reliability. Here's the goals for everybody. And the program manager, she was brilliant. She said, it looks like power supply. You know, George, power supplies are the weakest link on here. It was a series system. And what's it going to take to get a better power supply? Do we need redundancy? Do we need a more robust one? Do we need a redesign? What do you need to hit a better target? What's the trade-off between cost and how much better can you get? So the way she described it was you're the weakest link, and what resources do you need to get better, to get a better solution? And then that process happened every week, where she looked at the allocation and where our current estimates were and said, okay, power supply, for an extra $100, you're not the weakest link anymore, right? Let's make that happen. And then she turned over and looked at the hard drive, I think it was, and said, you're the weakest link. What are you going to do? And right. It became a regular feature of the program meeting. And it was based on that initial reliability allocation and then updating the estimates, and the estimates got more and more sophisticated and more robust as the program went on, as they needed to refine the unknown parts of what they had in their systems. And not only did they meet their overall objective, they gained back a tremendous amount of their market share at the end of the story, but it was really that notion of using the allocation as the starting point for an ongoing discussion.
That
was the flip side of all the pitfalls. It can be done.
So there really are some good uses of allocation, and don't want people to take it the wrong way about the pitfalls.
That's right.
It's just you have to avoid the pitfalls to get the benefit of reliability allocation.
Yeah, well said. So I imagine, Carl, you've run into a few other ones, and I'm sure our listeners have too. So let's ask them, did we miss any? And so head over to ascendoreliability.com/go/SOR. And there's a comment fields and forms to get in touch with us. And let us know, what pitfalls did we miss, or what stories do you have for that? We'd love to hear those. But also, you know, success stories also. I think that would be a nice bookend to this episode, Carl, is how to use allocation successfully. And what are the best practices kind of thing for it. So we'd love to hear some of those for a future episode. So, yeah, well, that sounds good. Good. So do you have access to, can we point to where that paper is, or make it available? Or?
Good point. I was just thinking about that. I think I'll put it on Ascendo.
Okay. That'd be good. We'll stick it on there.
I'll put it in the show notes for sure.
Okay. Perfect. All right. Well, thanks so much, Carl. Good idea. And I think I'm on my second cup of coffee, so I might be able to keep up with you for the rest of my day.
Okay. Very good, Fred. Thanks.
All right. Cheers. Thanks for listening to Speaking of Reliability. We invite you to join the conversation. If you have a question or a topic that you think we should discuss in a future show, please let us know. You can find a comment box below the episode show notes, or just leave a note as part of a review on iTunes.